This episode of The Ship Show is sponsored by PagerDuty. PagerDuty decreases alerting noise for operations and developers and ensures the right engineers are alerted at the right time. PagerDuty helps you identify common problems, allowing you to make system improvements proactively so you don't have to be woken up at 2 a.m., something nobody likes. Ship Show listeners can sign up for a free 14-day trial at www.pagerduty.com/theshipshow.
What is your one purpose in life? To ship, of course.
It's that time again. It's time for Build Engineering, DevOps, Release Management, and everything in between. It's The Ship Show. I'm your host, Paul Reed, SoberBuildEng on Twitter, and at SoberBuildEngineer.com. Who is with me for, not Studio 54, Episode 54?
This is Mike McGar at SonofGar on Twitter.
This is Seth Thomas at CheesePlus on Twitter.
This is Pete Cheslock at Pete Cheslock on Twitter.
And this is Yusuf at BuildScientist on Twitter.
How are we all doing? This is the first time we've gotten the crew together in the new year.
Yay!
Let's storm the castle! Hooray!
Pete, are you frozen? Is it like Ice Cube, Pete?
Yeah, and there's a lot of good analogies out there for either like Disney's Frozen movie kind of jokes that have been floating around. Also, there's been jokes around like, if we just admit that we deflated the balls, then God will stop dumping snow on us. nice Super Bowl reference for anyone right. who knows about deflate.
EJ was scheduled to join us, and he emailed, and he's like, we have no power, and I'm taking my family to his wife's sister's or something like that, and it was like, I've seen some of the like the temperatures. You kind of need something. Fire
that situation
or...
is actually a survival horror movie waiting. Yeah. Like that's a perfect intro to a some kind of like Boston survival horror during the blizzard. we could get a Netflix movie like that with that material.
Yeah,
we definitely reach a like lull worthy amount of snow. I mean, I was noticing as the plow trucks aren't plow trucks anymore. They're like front loaders or whatever, and so right. they're now like the snow is so high that they're doing. It's like higher than like the front load bucket that it uses to plow with. So it's just like you look outside and you're like, it's like 8-9 feet piles of snow just like on top of each other.
It's probably fine. On that note, actually, we are going to be talking episode 54 about packaging practices and gotchas. It's one of those things that we all kind of sling packages around all the time, but we're going to do a little bit of a technical deep dive on some good practices and things to think about when you are packaging your own software or you're responsible for managing the packages for your organizations. But first up, as we do, news and views all the time. So first item, we came across a new configuration management system called Configgy. I will link to it in the show notes. I don't know. What did you guys all think of this? It was my initial reaction was like, oh yeah, yet another configuration management system.
I'm not a big fan of the name for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of an easy to pronounce name. Otherwise, like, come on, this is how we market. This is like marketing 101, people.
I like some things about it just as much as I dislike some things about it. So it's kind of interesting because like I like Lua. That sounds cool. Like yeah. I'm down with that.
Is it cool? I mean, I thought Lua was mainly used in like game scripting.
It's used in other places. You can do like Nginx modules, I think, with Lua. There's some cool uses of Lua out there besides just, I mean, my favoritism from Lua does have a game origin and background, but it's nice. Like, I mean, I wouldn't mind writing things in it.
Yeah, on the main page, they have a list of their design decisions, and I think one of the really kind of interesting ones is they're sort of attacking this, you know, both Puppet and Chef have this big runtime, right? Because you have the Ruby runtime and all the modules, and they've kind of solved that with Omnibus and that sort of thing, but the Configgy executable with all of the modules is less than 300K. So I'm not saying it's good or bad, I'm just saying it's interesting that as a design decision, they kind of made that sort of front of mind. Some of the other design requirements, they do pull or push system, so they claim the ideal system is pull-based, but you can do push-based. They're not enforcing pure declarative policy, no packaging required, which that's kind of that leads into our discussion later, but no parallel execution, again, because they're trying to reduce complication and bloating of the runtime, minimal resource usage, so.
Yeah, I do like a lot of what it offers, but it offers those, specifically at the cost cost that I think a lot of other config management tools have found useful. So it's interesting. Like, if I wanted a super minimal thing, this seems like it would do the trick. But I've also stopped wanting the super minimal thing because there are reasons. Like, there's a lot of the bloat of the other ones comes at the cost of supporting, like, you know, lots more platforms. Like, they're like, yeah, we're not gonna supporting Windows, maybe BSD.
Right. Right.
One thing that's interesting about every time like a new config management thing comes out is like it comes out and it like the reason that people kind of trend towards it, you know, maybe this is a little bit on Salt and Ansible, but less now, is that it starts off, it's very simple, it's very easy to use, you know, it doesn't have the quote bloat of the older config management solutions. But then what inevitably happens over time is that people want more features, they want more additions, they want more support for things, and then it basically like turns into what it was trying to replace, and then and thus the cycle continues.
And it will get more config management tools, and then the ones I think that don't end up adopting, I think, the wider breadth of features, because they're like, we're going to say minimal, then nobody uses them, and especially enterprises don't attract to them. So it's kind of it depends on, I guess, what you're going for, too, like what you want. If it works for you, that sounds awesome.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, Jamie Zawinski of Netscape fame has a very famous quote where he's like, web browsers are complicated because the web is complicated. Like, people want to do complicated things on the web, right? And so to that point, it's like people want to do complicated things with configuration management. And in the browser space, it actually kind of reminds me of Firefox. It started out as this streamlined, really stripped down thing, and now it's become, people moved to Chrome because it was more streamlined than Firefox, because Firefox became sort of bloated. So it's just kind of to what you said, Pete, the pattern repeats itself. It'll be interesting to see, because one of their big things is small runtime, how does that interact with containers, right? There's this big thing where it's like, do you need configuration management in containers or whatever? And then in containers, you would want a small footprint because you usually have a smaller environment, or, you know, more lean environment. So it'll be interesting to see if it gains any traction in any of those spaces. Anyway, check it out. We'll look to it in the show notes. Next up, we have a post, actually an in-depth and quite long post, but it's a fascinating read on Secure Shell, actually, is the name of the post. And it basically goes through and talks about all of the options you should turn on and off in your Secure Shell configuration, because those algorithms are not to be trusted. Pete, you're our resident security person.
I always get called on for the security ones, but I actually did read this a few weeks ago, I think, when it came out. Oh yeah, it was January. That's right.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a big fan of any time that these come out. So I had to spend when we were kind of putting together the platform and kind of getting ready for our general availability. You know, we were spending some time and adding in, you know, using the right SSL certs and checking out all the different places in which we could secure it. And I really had a hard time finding a really good SSH kind of hardening thing. I mean, I ended up solving it by just, you can't SSH in from anywhere. You can only VPN in. So it's like, that's a way to solve it. But, you know, not everyone is kind of as lucky to be able to have that. And some people actually want, you know, that feature. Maybe they don't want the complexity of VPN, so they want SSH. And so there wasn't really at the time a lot of detailed, I mean, and this is detailed too. I mean, this is a really phenomenal blog post that goes into a lot of detail around the why.
Impressed.
Not just, like, flip this thing on and do it. So
right. Yeah. And it links. It's also, the thing I really liked about it is that when it tells you don't use algorithm X, it actually, some of it is kind of tongue in cheek, because it's like, don't use this because NIST curves suck. But there's a link that goes to the research about why you shouldn't use X. It's not just trust me on this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the part of this that what makes us, I mean, as is, it's great. What really takes us to the next level is those references to other research papers about it. So.
Well, actually, I don't think that's what takes it to the next level. What I think takes it to the next level is it has little cut and paste things that you can stick right in your SSH config. So if you like don't know what to type and stuff, you can just cut and paste.
He pretty much tells you to do that just in the TLDR. He's like, if you don't want to read this all, just cut and paste everything in text font and move
right.
on.
Right. He kind of points out that if you have to support old clients, there was something in here about, was that this story where it was like they couldn't turn SSH 1 off because of the change control board was like, you can't turn SSH 1 off for whatever dumb reason. And it's like, well, you do realize that you're just exposing your entire, you know, network to problems because you can't turn this broken thing off. But yeah, he goes into the details. So yes, if you're wanting to harden SSH, take a look at that post. We'll link to it in the show notes. Next up, something I think, Yusuf, you pointed us to this. So I lost my NAS password. What happened when he lost his NAS password?
What happened when he lost his NAS password? So basically, apparently he lost his admin password, but he had a user password of some sort and proceeded to get a config backup and then kind of sort of reverse engineer his way back through the actual firmware, ended up downloading the actual firmware off of the Western Digital NAS device and modifying some code to basically store passwords differently and then re-upload that sort of modified firmware backup into his device and then basically get his admin password. I thought it was a nifty little article. You know, I like these little kind of consumerish, hacky kind of things. But yeah, the point, I guess the TLDR on this one is don't put these type of consumer-oriented NAS devices out on the internet.
I think what is more interesting when I was reading it from a kind of release engineering standpoint is part of the thing that allowed them to do this was they downloaded the GPL sources, mm-hmm. which they have to, you know, they have to release, Western Digital has to release, and those sources contained everything, not just the kernel and whatever, and that's how they were able to reverse engineer it and kind of hack it. And so what I thought, that's what I thought was interesting, is there's really a release, like, it seems like the TLDR there, or the implicit TLDR there, is that for these, a lot of these consumer products, the release engineering just is not that good, and it actually has real consequences.
Yeah, I think at one point, the person who wrote the article mentioned that somebody had left the version control log, like the full version control log and whatever
it is. I'm going to quote that here because it's so great. It's like, why Western Digital published everything? We have no idea. I mean, there's a file called AAA with a VCS log in there, and the log is CBS, which you would expect. The author apparently listed as Wiley, whoever that is, and they wrote it in 2006.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing is also, I mean, from a larger sort of standpoint, understand what your attack vectors are. I'm sure Pete can kind of talk about that a lot more. But yeah, don't put your Western Digital or whatever consumer device NASs out on the internet.
Yeah, as the article says, anyway, from here it's downhill and horrible and hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, but Paul, you were mentioning the release engineering. You're talking about specifically open source licensing and checking for that. Is that your point there?
Oh, no. My point is that I find it interesting that I think they probably were only required to release like the kernel modifications and some of the things they made for the NAS, and they literally included all of the PHP source, all of the web source, like everything, and that's how they were able to go through and look at how the configuration backup like blob that it generates. That's how they were able to reverse engineer it. Is by looking through the PHP that was shipped with the entire open source tarball. So I think, and I've seen this before, where people are like, oh, we need to do the open source stuff so nobody really does the research, and they just ship this blob that ships way more than they really should ship, and it has consequences. It's just bad release engineering. It's sloppy, for lack of a better word. So last up, we have a post from Alex Gaynor on the GitHub's. It's a repo entitled What Happens When? It's kind of a fun little thing, and it's an attempt to answer the age-old interview question, what happens when you type google.com into your browser's address box and press enter? And of course, the point of that interview question, right, is where it's a good, like, where do people focus, right? Where do you see people, like, focusing their attention in an interview? But it's gotten kind of crazy. Did you guys see this?
This is just amazing. I saw this when it popped up kind of around the internet, and I think I spent, you know, the first little bit on literally the first option, which is when the enter key bottoms out.
Right.
And it gets into the details of the circuitry and what's being sent and everything. It's just, you know, and then it's like, oh wait, this is not for USUQ, and then it's like, oh, and by the way, for Windows, or here's for Linux and
Mac. Yeah, 48 contributors have put in various items. I mean, this could just go on for, I think, forever.
It's impressive because there'll always be some layer that you will end up dissecting more than the last person. I feel like this is, you could just like have people work on this for the rest of their lives and
I know
they finish.
It would be beautiful.
That's scary.
yeah, it's pretty awesome. Now take a look. We'll link to it in the show notes, of course. Next up, packaging good practices, packaging gotchas. Here on the Ship Show. Oh, All right, welcome back to Ship Show. I'm your host, Paul Reed. So for our main topic tonight, we're talking about packaging, good practices, gotchas with packaging. It's a very interesting topic. We had this brought up to us because we had the question, how do you prepare released or releasable binaries? It's one of those things that we kind of rely on more than we think about, and there's lots of every place sort of does it a little bit differently. I think a lot of times it starts out with just use FPM because it is so easy and convenient to use. For those of you not familiar with FPM, we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's an easy way to generate different types of packages. But it's a little bit limiting in terms of it is sort of generalized kind of Swiss Army knife of package creation. And so sometimes some of the package-specific features you may not get access to. So we wanted to talk a little bit about this thing that we all use all the time and some of the issues that we might not even know that we're struggling with. So first of all, Yusuf, we started talking about this in the context of, you know, why package at all? What's the purpose of that? What do packages give us when we're, you know, in the whole kind of, why bother? What's wrong with curl bash and tarballs?
Sure. I think when you look at packaging, you have to sort of think of it as a transport mechanism, meaning I want to be able to get a set of files or one file or, you know, any number of files from one place, you know, wherever the actual package is generated, out to X number of machines. Or
to use floppies for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or FTP. I mean,
people. Yeah.
And I also think of it as kind of a binary distribution mechanism. So, mm-hmm. you know, those are sort of two things that I, you know, whenever somebody asks me or whenever I think of what a package is, that's what comes to mind.
But so that's interesting, right? Because I think that's the common case that a lot of people think about, that it's about distributing binaries or configuration or transporting things. I mean, I when we think of Linux packages, and I mentioned floppies, I was thinking back to, was it Slackware that came with all the floppies, like the 48 floppies?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that you had to, right? And so that was sort of the mechanism after floppies is to kind of do it on packages. But there's an important aspect about security and identity. That can sign your packages and know where they came from and that you know that no one tampered with them. I mean, remember, this was the point behind like Tripwire and tools like that. You know, they were system specific, but it's like if somebody sent you an RPM, like how would you know that they came from the right person, right?
Yep.
That's another kind of aspect that we don't often talk about.
I was going to say, that's why you use, I mean, it's also why you use package managers like, you know, apt and yum. They have facilities with which you can, you know, accept repos from other people, and it made it easier.
All right.
It made it easier to actually exist in an ecosystem where you may have multiple different repositories, multiple different ways in which to obtain packages. So you see that a lot of people are using it because it's an incumbent system that has also got a certain level of security via signing of packages.
Right, and I remember back in the day, do you remember how, like, originally everybody had, like, their distro package repo, right, and people were trying to get packages into it, but then to your point, I mean, you know, now you can add different and multiple repositories, and so you don't have to deal with that problem. Like, that is the common use case now, is that you add an additional repository, and then that might be some company.
This is true. Unfortunately, being on the other end of actually maintaining a repository, you know, for a third-party product, it's miserable and an unloving experience because something always goes wrong. There's always some like weird case condition with these boxes, and they tend to be boxes that are, in especially in my past experience, that are forgotten about. You know, that it's like, mm-hmm. oh, somebody, we have to fire up the builders. Like, you have to like stoke them with coal. because like services like Package Cloud are great because I can just like throw all of my binary. Like, I still may have to maintain builders, but I can throw all my binaries at them and be like, you pretend to be an after a yum repo because I cannot be bothered.
Right.
And I think that it's kind of interesting because it was such a successful and popular method of delivery for so long, but it's never something you really want to maintain, and it's not exactly great, or you know, to have to maintain that infrastructure or desirable. So it's kind of it's interesting that is got such high levels of popularity, but at the same time, nobody really wants to do it if they can avoid it.
Well, it's interesting too. Like when you start looking at those systems, you tend to see they have a lot of really weird features because a lot of them were designed to handle free and cheap distribution. So what I mean by that is, like, you know, you see all of these weird features in Yum and Apt because they are striving for the use case of putting a Debian repo at Oregon State University or, you know, these universities that offer cheap hosting to open source projects.
Yeah, and there's some interesting things with how those are maintained and then watching. It's kind of like a lot of those systems were built for a time, like you're saying, that just doesn't really exist anymore, and you're trying to send like the minimal amount of bandwidth, and now it's like, I have a gigabit connection at home. I can download, you know, sure, give me the 9 gig DVD, you know, DVD right. version of this distro.
Well, and I can tell you, it's funny, Mozilla actually back in the day spent a bunch of time and effort supporting the ability to download their artifacts via this distributed kind of Debian or,
The Jigdo stuff or whatever, what was that?
No, it was just, they did a bunch of work to make sure that their updates and their installers, you could validate that you were getting the right thing from some random third party because they didn't have the money to run these huge pipes and disk arrays and stuff, and now they do, right? Now they Mozilla Corporation has the money to do that, so that becomes less of a, you know, less important. So it's just interesting, the requirements. I wanted to deep dive a little bit into the types of packages because I think a lot of us think, like, RPMs and Debs, maybe if you use an Arch Linux, you've got, you know, weird packagey tarballs in there. I think we're all pretty familiar with RPMs and Debs, yes? Those are kind of bread and butter, would you say?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Bread and butter, but at the same time, once you've made a Deb or an RPM, you are terrified and appalled that those packaging systems exist.
You really wonder how the internet even works.
Right.
Yeah, so let's go into that. Why do you say that, Seth? I mean,
I've done this a few times, and, like, a lot of times you're, like, looking at a standard, and then you try to adhere to the standard, and there's, like, the standard on paper, and they're like, yeah, but this thing just doesn't work. And you're like...
Right.
Oh my, and there's lots of facepalming, it's pain, and setting up the corresponding repos, like I said, Package Cloud has been, like, a really cool thing to come on the scene, because it's like, hey, we know you need to maintain these things, but you don't want to, we'll maintain this as a meta thing. Great. Right. Take that problem away from me, because I've looked at the scripts, and for the most part, they're varying in quality, but like, you've got to build this, like, kind of artisanal repo yourself. And then then you know it's terribly put together. You know it's all bad. Like, you know, then you do really weird things to get it to work.
Right.
You don't ever do it again.
So I will say this. It's funny. I've done the thing where it's like you do a third-party package, and it's a commercial company, right? And you put your commercial binaries in your RPM or your Deb or whatever, and then you run it through the RPM lint tool, and Debian has a lint tool too, like a linter for the package, and it just spits out, like, your package has 8 trillion problems with it. And it's because they're all things that are like, these don't meet the Debian free software guidelines. And you're like, fuck those. I just tried to get this thing on my customers' machines. But, you know, right? And I've run into that problem.
Errors in there where you just look at it and you're like, you know what? I've basically got to pretend, I've got to remember that none of this matters and I don't care.
Right. And of course, it's funny, right, in some sense, because this is the weird dichotomy, is that we've kind of all been on the source side of creating packages and managing repositories and all this stuff. But of course, we all take, and I've done this too, we all take to Twitter when you're just like, who the f*** did this package? It's so f***ed up. You know,
I mean, there's a lot of hate out there even for the more recent, you know, usage of, or I guess diversion away from kind of the Linux standard base file system hierarchy.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is, I can go both ways on this one for sure, but, like, people dumping stuff into Opt, right? Everyone puts stuff in Opt nowadays.
I was just about to say, I was like, when in doubt, put that shit in Opt, right?
Right.
Which is what you do.
Yeah, but you do it. And so the thing that I always say is when people are like, but what if you're going to do an OS upgrade and you're going to lose all the stuff in X? And I'm like, I haven't upgraded an OS in about a decade because I just, like, cloud or whatever. Like,
right.
Right. Like, who does in-place upgrades?
Well, and it is one of those things. It's interesting, right? A lot of the, especially in third-party packages that get shipped like that, that's where you see everybody kind of hates on Omnibus and the fact that it doesn't reuse things. VMware is another one, and I give those guys mad props. I used to do some of that work when I worked back there, some of the package stuff. And the fact that stuff works on the number of distros that it works on is amazing, but they ship like GTK, you know, the GTK libraries with VMware, because who knows what crazy randomness some Debian maintainers made a change to, like they did with OpenSSL and screwed everyone with OpenSSH, right? Because they didn't understand what was going on. Like, ain't nobody got time for that, right? So right. There's this weird sort of trade-off there.
There's a part, too, that with the install, dumping it into Opt, at least, and I could say this from, like, personal experiences as well as, you know, just as a user, is that the uninstall aspect of it, like, uninstalling something you put in Opt means removing the folder in Opt that you put in there. Removing
right.
something that you sprayed across the entire OS. And also, as a user, when I install a package, I kind of want to be like, well, where did all this stuff go? And it's like, either I have to remember the arcane dpackage command that tells me where all the stuff went, or I'm like, oh, it's all in Opt, and I go to Opt and I see like a whole file system tree there. So
I
think that stuff, and I'm like, go, you know what, I'm just gonna let it happen.
No, you got to be careful with that. Just remove the folder. This is a Windows installer horror story, so it's a little different than what you were talking about, Pete, but it's a great example of like some of the weird things that people will do with your packages. So this was a Windows package, and we had the same format. It was like, to uninstall just rmrf, like the install folder. Well, it turns out that this was a media player, and somebody made the installation folder the root folder of their music library, and then they uninstalled the application, and their music library went bye-bye.
Well, that's clearly the user's problem. I mean, let's be honest.
Well, that was one of those, like, but you're like, wow, you know, I think packaging in general, it's one of those really underrated and undervalued, like I don't know, I started my career out of college doing installers, and it is hard work. It's hard
installers
work.
Installers are miserable.
Yeah.
I'll tell you all a secret. If you're ever playing video games, you know, on PCs, and you always click to install the game, and then it's like, hey, man, I need to install, like, four different DirectX packages, and like all these like random other utilities. People are like, why? I already have this package installed. And the answer to that is, no, you don't have that specific version installed, because whatever game studio made your game tested against a very specific build, and they don't have time to actually try and support a cross-section of any of the other builds, so
right.
they pick one, and that's what ships with the game. So
right.
you end up like with all of these like, but I swore I installed that. It's like, no, you installed 17 different versions of that, and that's okay, because packages.
Right.
A lot of this conversation seems to be centered around long-running servers or even desktops and installers. And someone mentioned the cloud and actually having, I don't run upgrades on my servers. So migrating things to the cloud and actually having ephemeral servers, how does that change your deployment, your packaging model? Because you can actually just assume, for instance, maybe you're just going to install on a fresh server every single time.
I actually build from source more and generate artifacts ahead of time even more and stop caring about the actual packages more so, I think. It depends on if I'm making like a product that is being distributed. So like on the chef side, like I need an RPM or something to give to you at the end of the day. But I stop focusing on packages. I just like, here, I'm going to build this from source and then push it out because I've locked down my images are so... They're ephemeral and I can rebuild them easily.
So it's interesting, Mike. I think what I've noticed is you see, and I see this with my clients that I've been working with that have packaging, you know, that's the project. There's a lot less concern about the upgrade path and even the uninstallation path. Like the packaging code in the RPM or the deb for those use cases becomes nothing because they just don't care. It's like, we're going to throw the whole server away. And it's interesting, right? The more interesting question, Mike, would be then, you know, like, how do you communicate that to your customers that, like, uninstalls aren't expected to work? You know what I mean?
Yeah, uninstall is like wipe the OS and put a new VM on there, right? Like
right, or you know, destroy the container and
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Run it up again.
I'm sorry, you cared about that AMI? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, so I you'll be able to help with this, Mike, I'm sure. Java, deploying Java packages, the venerable WAR files and jars and all that kind of stuff. That's an area of packaging that is complicated and used all over the place, but
it's insufficient. But like, yeah, a WAR file is insufficient. Like, there, even if you have a very simple WAR file, you're going to need to configure like the runtime container, and immediately you're outside of the scope of what like the Java spec can handle, right? And so whenever I've had to deploy,
designed to be not useful enough.
Exactly.
So I've actually written an installer for a set of Java web services, and
did it make you sad?
It was a good exercise, but I think the installation framework that I put together, I wrote it in Python, kind of alluded to some deeper sort of architectural issues with how the software is kind of put together. Because at some point there were things like, we need you to deploy these homegrown jars that are used across these different web services. So you stick them with, and I'm sure Mike knows what I'm talking about, but stick them in the common, like if you're deploying the Tomcat, stick them in the common jar or the shared jar directory. And then, make sure that it's this one and this version of the jar versus that one. And so painful but useful exercise, yeah.
So traditional Java apps, WAR files, do not run outside of a container like Tomcat or JBoss. And so they need to be put in a specific place and assume the environment is set up properly. You're seeing in the Java space specifically that these WARs are actually transforming into kind of more EXE-like. So you can do sudo java-jar on the WAR name, and it just runs like any other Java program.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting projects. I know Jenkins uses this thing called Windstone, and then the Spring Foundation, they've come up with Spring Boot, which they're doing some interesting work around that area with getting sort of fully sort of self-contained Java web services / applications.
Yeah, but even then, there's probably going to be a environment variable at the minimum that file's going to need. And so at that point, then you're outside the scope of like, you're going to do some scripting, you're going to do some configuration management, or you're just going to do what we do, which is just put that WAR inside of a Debian package and install it on that OS.
And I think, that's the kind of a key or sort of inherent limitation of packages in general. I mean, even if you're putting together a spec file for an RPM that has like a post-install step that does that type of stuff, what if that needs to change, and how many people actually version control spec files, or even, yeah.
We always version control the spec file because that's like code like anything else. But that is, that's a fascinating point. It's like for that ecosystem, it seems like the packaging solution, as you said, wasn't enough. And so you see people kind of doing all of these weird sort of turtles, right? Layers of like turtles all the way down, which actually that was the other side. I mean, we referenced this before, you brought it up, installers, MSIs. Anyone remember Install Shield? Seth, you got to remember Install Shield. You probably have to.
That's old school.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah. I remember it. Because that's what you use on Windows. There's always this conversation at a game studio when you're making stuff, and then you realize it's actually time to pick the installer, and it's just like, here's a buffet of terrible options that I get to go with. Like, some have certain size limits. Like when I was making one for an MMO, you know what I used? I used just the UNRAR installer because it was actually the most flexible.
You're a bad man. That's horrible.
We licensed it. It was fine. We paid for the license.
No, it's not that, but it's just like you'd have to get every – if you've got no way to like execute post-configuration stuff, you got to make sure you like get all that right.
Oh, we did. There was a lot of testing that went into the pipeline to make these types of installers because they were just – each one had its own unique kind of like magic incantation. And there was documentation doesn't even exist for half of these.
So NSYS, if you remember, anyone remember NSYS? Yeah, so I had to write NSYS. NSYS was the Nullsoft installer, so it's Winamp. And the thing about that is, like, you were literally writing assembly. It was installer assembly, and you basically, the way you would write your installer is you would get these various incantations, like these 5 to 10 line incantations that you would Google for that would do random things, and it had registers, and if you wanted some function, like if you wanted to pop up a dialog box or something in some weird way that there wasn't a module or whatever for, like you could totally do it, but the way you did it is you had to put the address of the DLL in a register and then like call the Microsoft DLL, it would pop up the dialog. It was like, what the f***?
It actually does. I mean, to be honest, it did make me long for making a deb. I will tell you that. I was like, man, I could make a deb.
It almost makes you want to port RPM or deb over to Windows.
There's packaging on that side is just so it's funny because the installers feel like users, like they see those installers typically and they're like, these are professional. It's like, this is a house of cards. You have no idea if anything is going to work.
And that is one of those things, again, that, I mean, I think the reason that I got stuck doing installer work right out of school is because it's the job nobody wants, right? It's the
nobody ever
wants. The ship job, the job on the team, and it's sad because it's so, like, why do we complain about it so much? Because
it takes a lot of effort and a lot of really specific domain knowledge that
very detail oriented
that you wouldn't ever expect anyone to know unless they actually had to go through the exercise of doing it. Like, it's not something you learn like in school or in a class. It's something that you are very clearly like taught, and like you said, it's always at the end of the cycle, and it's always dropped on usually the least expecting or like the least well-prepared person to necessarily do it.
Right.
And it's treated as kind of like, you know, like junk work, even though it's super important. Like, it's like all of the software in the world that you write, if it doesn't compile and go into a nice, convenient executable and an installer, like, what good is it?
Right.
You're never going to deliver to customers.
And it's funny, to your point, the bit about, like, nobody teaches it in school. The main thing that you need to learn here is all of the weird ways that people are going to install your package and use it. And there's no way to learn that than to just get a bug report that, you know, my music collection got blown away because some user installed the thing there, or somebody installed this RPM in a CH root, and they're using your 32-bit RPM on a 64-bit architecture with no multi-lib installed, and it doesn't, you know, just weird stuff like that.
I'll admit, having come from a help desk background before I got into, you know, making installers and release engineering, making it a lot easier because, like, oh yeah, somebody's totally going to do that. Like, they're going to do this and it's going to be wrong. And you're going to let them because you didn't think, oh God, why would somebody do that? And so you have to really prepare yourself a little bit up front to be like, these are all the bad ways that people are going to hit bugs with your installer.
Paul, a lot of what you're saying too is that, you know, all of these edge cases and all of these one-offs, like, that's really the problem that Omnibus kind of solved for us. And, you know, seeing more and more packages getting built with Omnibus and deployed in that way. I mean, Vagrant is a great example. The Vagrant project is a great example of shipping out via Omnibus because of all the edge cases within the Ruby environment around versions of Ruby itself and those versions of gems. You know, Mitchell just basically said, you know what, I'm just going to ship everything. Like, I'm going to ship the whole Ruby and all the gems.
Didn't that happen with Chef?
That's perfect.
Yep. Didn't that happen with Chef too, where some MD5 or SHA-1, some gem library or something changed something and it just screwed everyone?
It happens on just about everything in the Ruby ecosystem, right. I feel like, at some point, which is why people who are trying to make for various platforms always end up moving to an Omnibus approach, because it's entirely sensible. I mean, even when I was using OpenLDAP, if you actually got the binaries, you know, the actual, like, licensed support binaries from CIMAS, who makes it, I mean, they would actually bundle, like, other libraries that were expected to be on your system in most other Linux packages, but you didn't want to trust them.
Right.
And so they were linked against those. Because the idea was like, oh, well, you want to link against all the system libs. And it's like, yeah, but you can't trust the system libs because they're liars and each one is their own unique, like, brand of wrong, typically.
Well, and here's the thing. I am a Gentoo user. I am a proud Gentoo user. But when you have people compiling their libraries with every -F GCC option and optimization, it's no wonder like half of the stuff doesn't work. Right? I mean, they've fun rolled too many loops and it doesn't work anymore.
I was going to say that I was reminded of the Omnibus packaging question is actually by a Gentoo user. They were having trouble getting Chef to work, you know, from a gem. And I was like, oh yeah, Ruby environments are terrible. Like, just go, you know, make your own Omnibus installer. And they were like, oh no, my Ruby's fine. It's the one that's provided. And I'm like, actually, here, let's look at your Ruby. And this is where your Ruby's broken. Like, right here. And this is why we do the Omnibus thing. It's like, sorry, we can't support your platform because it's an edge case. But at the same time, the reason we don't do that is because your platform already, you know, every platform ends up having one of these problems.
So this is an interesting question I wanted to ask the panel. I mean, we've gone through, and actually this was one of the items on the types of packaging and you know, going through the pros and cons of each, the gems and eggs, you know, the Ruby and Python packages. Is this a problem with Ruby? And you see it to some extent with Python and Perl as well, but
you also see it in the Node and JavaScript worlds as well. I mean,
yes.
I think it's a problem with how open source projects. I mean, it's a problem with humans is really the end result, right? You're depending on other humans to follow some semblance of software versioning with their stuff. And
certainly, no. But do you think it's a problem with the technology? And we see this pattern repeated, like you just said, Node, Python, Ruby. So I'm not hating on any of those. It's just, you know, this reminds me actually a little bit of Go and how they do it, where they're like, you basically, everything that gets compiled is an Omni. I mean, it's not Omnibus, but it's,
That's why I love the Go distribution model. Like, that is beautiful. It's
now, walk us through that.
I am not an expert on it, but like, just the fact that I am spitting out OS-specific binaries and I don't have to deal with like sending you a gem or whatever, like, and for a runtime, for a custom,
cross-compiling on Go is actually, like, it's easy enough that I can do it, which I think says something pretty massive there.
It's like a pleasure.
I think a strong advantage for that, you know, like when I use like Packer, for example, which is, you know, another tool that is used to create an artifact, albeit usually like a virtual box or an AMI type artifact, but Packer is written in Go. So it's like when I go to get it, and it's funny, when you go to get Packer, you actually just get a tar.gz. So like, if you get Vagrant, you get, you know, a nice DMG that actually installs, you know, and has an installer if you're on OS X. But if you're using Packer, it's like, oh yeah, here's a tarball, go nuts. Like,
and it just runs.
We'll just copy these into basically wherever you can. I mean, you copy them, I put them in, you know, like user local bin or whatever the, you know, the reasonably appropriate spot is. But yeah, you can just run them from your downloads folder.
So to bring up another type that as actually a kind of a new type of packaging, you know, and we mentioned it a few times, OS images, AMIs, Docker containers, is that... Where's the packaging overlap there?
When we talked about packaging and while Yusuf's definition certainly comes to mind of like there are files and these things, I stopped thinking about packages as much as artifacts, and I like the term artifact better because it's like here is a thing, like a deliverable thing.
So what's the distinction for you?
Well, a package is a narrower distinction. Mm-hmm. I think a package is an artifact. Mm-hmm. But I think packages is very much like gets us in the mindset of like installers, like whether it's, you know, a Windows installer or a Deb or an RPM on Linux, whereas artifacts can be, you know, like a WAR or it can be like an ISO, for example. So like for me, a deliverable a lot of the times when we were making games wasn't just the package. That was cool that I could package it up for like an Xbox, but I actually had to make it into an ISO so that we could play it on things.
Right.
So I've actually used the kind of OS image approach, you know, before their AMIs, even when it was for game servers, because it was way cheaper to just like have like a clone. Like you just could slot in a new hard drive and like do the appropriate like Linux, you know, config flips to make it like let it know it's a, you know, here's a new, you know, it's an OS, but here you're gonna, this is your IP and this is all of your other specific information, and then just go. And then you just rsync, you know, the game or whatever on top of that distribution because you didn't want to care about installing or configuring packages. The server was just a vessel for this one application.
Right. So actually I wanted to bring that up because there's two remaining sort of styles of packaging that we haven't talked about and that are still common. So everybody kind of makes fun of tarballs, but a lot of places still do kind of what you said. And it's even easier, a little bit easier, if you're set up from an orchestration perspective to just have machines that are configuration managed, and then you dump the you know, objects for your application on there, and then when you don't want it anymore, you blow the whole thing away. That's a model. So I wanted to talk a little bit about pros and cons, because we sort of all make fun of the tarball model, and then also the curl bashing model. So why do people bash curl bash, and then everybody proceeds to do it?
So curl bash is like, I've got okay, hold on a second here. All right.
And
so,
by the way, one thing, if you're not familiar with curl bashing,
see the chef install site.
Yeah. Or really any product. So here's gonna be my like rant on curl bashing. And
I'm gonna get some popcorn. Go ahead.
It's good. So curl bash exists because as we're spending the last 45 minutes or so talking about it, this packaging is a giant pain in the ass, right? And most of the time your application doesn't require just the package. It requires certain things to be set, certain things to be in place, files to be configured, whatever, things that are kind of like outside the realm of the package itself. And so, you know, you want like an install script. Well, so people basically are using curl bash as a way to, and this is like the Pete's product mind coming into place, is something that reduces the time to value. So the quicker I can get functional and using a product, the more likely I'm going to continue to use that product. So now that's why people curl bash a lot. And there's a lot of projects out there that do curl bash, and people are like, oh my God, it's insecure, blah, blah, blah. Well, here's going to be my flip side to curl bash on whether it's secure or not. Now, yes, you're curling an unknown script, right, from a site. And the site is probably HTTPS. If it's not, then yeah, that's probably not good. So let's say you're curling down this unknown script from a site. So let's replace that with a Debian package. You apt-get install this PGP signed Debian package. Hopefully it's signed, because in some cases it may not be. And you install that package. What are those scripts that are running to actually install the package? It's bash or sh scripts that install it, that you're running without looking at. So in one mind, I say, like, yes, it's probably insecure because there's not the key signing aspect. And there's ways to, like, get the packets in transit. But the real reality is that the end result is very close to the same. And especially when SSL is involved on the curl side to the site, it's far less likely to be an actual security risk versus what people kind of make it out to be. Because at the end of the day, like, you're still running these scripts blindly from someone else's machine.
Let me blindly install a package. Like, people always are like, well, you never know what's in the package. I'm like, well, have you ever actually looked? And usually most people don't. And you wouldn't want to, because it's mostly boilerplate and terrible nonsense to get through a standard mechanism. And then the rest of it, I mean, you probably don't know what it means. So it's
if you're building an application and you want to get people using it as fast as possible. And so, I mean, I can speak from very recent experience, and I know Paul is, because he's been helping me on this project. Paul actually works for me the past few months, which has been a fun project. But we've been literally spending months trying to get a good workflow and good packaging around basically our application that my company sells into, you know, a better package, CI, managed kind of setup there. And it's not like it's a quick thing, whereas the curl bash that was created months and months ago to deliver the product was done in a day, and it was shipped out there. And so if you're a four-person startup, are you going to invest months and months to try to get packaging dealt with? The answer is you're probably not, because packaging is a giant pain in the ass.
Yeah, I mean, from what I hear right there is curl bashing is a great MVP, a great starter to get something delivered now, but it's not a long-term solution.
Yeah, and I definitely want to have the other options.
The huge point is that it should always, like, there should always, and in our product, the one that we sell, there's a curl bash. It'll never go away. We don't want to get rid of it, because when people come and sign up, the first place that we find that they're installing the agent is on a Vagrant box. So what's the fastest way to get on your Vagrant box? Curl bash it down. But if you want, like, there's the links to how to add it, the Yum repo, the app repo, or whatever you want to do from there. Here's your chef cookbook, here's your pub cookbook. But for most people, when they get going, they just want to try it out. Curl bash, it's like the perfect way to get started. But then, like, yeah, like you're saying, it's like, it's not something, it doesn't really scale, because when you want to deploy this thing to hundreds or thousands of servers, that's the point where you want to have these maintained repos.
Yeah, well, so, you know, where I've seen that and it's been very useful is, when I first heard of curl bashing, it was foreign to me, and I was like, holy God, what are you doing to my beautiful machine wanting to do this? Because that is, I think, very scary, and a lot of people that have, you know, been using Linux and package managers for a really long time, that's a total non-starter. It's a very scary idea, and I think part of the reason for that is that it takes away your ability to look at what's going on, because at any point, at any time, the remote entity, the company or whatever, can change what's in that script, or they could hear, even worse, if they don't protect that machine, even if it is HTTPS, and somebody puts a script in there. Can you imagine somebody hacks that curl bash script? That would be horrible.
Actually, to that point, I think what you nailed on is my biggest complaint with the curl bash, due to the dubious security like you're kind of talking about, but the main one is it's not versioned, meaning I can't pin install this specific curl bash, where at least with a package itself, I can say, I want 4.2.1, and if the company sends 4.2.2 or whatever other version, then I don't want it. I'm pinned version, and you can't obviously do that.
Well, right. And so to your point, though, Pete, I think you make a really, really good rational argument, and the answer is a lot of times people that don't want to change and have been using Linux forever and want their RPMs and devs, like, they just don't, you know, they don't want to change. And so it's just very kind of I don't want to say scary for them, but it's just
from
like
my cold dead hands.
Exactly. And so though I think the way that you can kind of move forward, and I've seen packages make this transition, I think, Mike, that you're spot on with your comment that it's an MVP. What you can end up doing is moving. So basically the bash script that you curled and run ends up becoming add the repo to the package management files, install the package, and then run the configuration script that is part of the package. And so that curl bash becomes nothing more than something you could do manually with the package. And then it turns out for big companies that want to pin their versions or whatever, all they're going to do is they're going to take your package and they're going to run that configuration script that's already in the package anyway. So what you end up doing is taking that logic in your curl bash, moving it to the package, and then just making the curl bash that nice MVP experience for people that just want to play around with it. But for people that have to operationalize it, you actually have a story for that that works for them with their configuration management system of choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, once you get and start deploying, even for us to show people how to like install the RPM or the apt package from one of our repos, the thing we're getting more asked much more about is like, hey, do you have like an Ansible manifest or Puppet thing? Or so I think we're moving towards that world where people actually just want like, just give me the config management code. I've already got Chef. You know, where what line do I add to my Berks file? You know, it's like
right.
That's what we're getting asked. It's not like where's your document on how to set up the app repo. It's like, hey, what can I include in my Berks file so I can install this thing?
I've really stopped caring about the packages because those to me are just components of me. You know, if I'm building a server, it's like, well, I'm going to write the config management ahead of time so I can build this thing, and then when I build it, like, I don't even really care where the packages come from. If there's not an omnibus, I'll just build it from source because my config management is going to do that for me. So, problem solved.
So there's obviously curl bashing. There's lots of stuff going on there. The one last one that we kind of Seth, you sort of brought this up. I think a lot of people, Mike, are going to be wondering about this. When your package is like an AMI or an OS image, like you're saying, Seth, a Vagrant image, how does that change your thinking about package management when it's this big thing?
Well, it gets more interesting, but thankfully there seem to be nice tools that have emerged for that. Because I remember back, there was a time when you were making Vagrant boxes where like making a good Vagrant box was actually like something that you had to try to do, like making a good standardized Vagrant box,
right,
that you could then distribute to others that didn't have some weird idiosyncrasy. And so when we were, especially on the, so I've been using the Chef Bento boxes for a long time, and they're just pre-configured boxes that, you know, with Vagrant, and we were using, I think, VWE at first,
mm-hmm.
and it just had so many problems trying to replicate that on other people's systems, because there's problems with VWE and problems, little problems that software just has.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember when we cut over to Packer, a lot of that, I mean, granted, Packer had, you know, had growing issues as well, but it was also much more consistent across people's platforms because of the actual distribution mechanism was now a Go-based thing,
mm-hmm.
with nice little like JSON definitions versus VWE, which was significantly more complicated architecturally, and it was also a Ruby ecosystem thing. So it inherited all the fundamental problems that you have with a Ruby ecosystem in terms of packaging and delivering things. So once Packer kind of really established itself, it made delivering these like static AMIs or virtual boxes or VMware Fusion boxes, it just made it super duper easy. It was kind of one of those, once you had the perfect tool, you're like, well, crap, I just change my JSON definition and I can spit this thing out for whatever platform. And I really, at that point, like the idea of setting up, like I had to work with a partner and they were like, oh yeah, I've got to install this ISO. And I'm like, oh, what? You don't have like a Vagrant box or like an OVA, mm-hmm. or something I can just,
right.
I don't want to install something and configure something. I want you to just give me a thing, because treating these things like appliances and like these artifacts is...
We've all gotten lazy with the VMware play button. And like a VCR, it's like, I want my Betamax cassette and I want to put it in and press play.
Right, I just want to put it in, and like I just want a Vagrant box, you know, especially when I'm like trying to reproduce an issue. If I've got a Vagrant box, then I can just do a test kitchen run and like basically have a whole, you know, mocked up test system.
Right.
You know, in you know, we're talking minutes as opposed to being like, hold on, let me install this and configure it. So I think the importance of these artifacts of AMIs and like Vagrant boxes is super important, especially from a testing perspective, because you're able to deliver this kind of base level platform as an artifact, and then you just test against that. You don't worry about what if Jeff User installed upgraded Apache 2 and like Jeff User isn't even able to log into the computer in this scenario. Like when we upgrade Apache 2, we put that in our Packer definition, and then we test that Packer definition in our staging environments, and then we deploy it to live. Right. And you never, and like Pete's saying, who upgrades things anymore? Like that was such a big deal for so long, and now it's like, who upgrades? Like, who actually does that? People ask me that for like a cookbook. They're like, did you cover this upgrade case? I'm like, do people upgrade still? Is that a thing? Like,
you're getting many
people. Yeah, yeah.
You're getting
I know. Coming from the Windows side, I know people do upgrade packages and these things. The cases that you have to cover are insane. But for a lot of us in our day to day, we don't. It's become a non-issue because of these other methods of delivery things.
Yeah, agreed. But I think certainly you should. So I think we should test that. We should still continue to test upgrades. But having said that, I always do kind of laugh when somebody's like, I tried to upgrade my Ubuntu 10 LTS machine to Ubuntu 14 and it broke. And you're like, well, yeah, it's not going to
happen. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah. Mike, though, I wanted to ask too, how do you see handling these sort of AMIs with a package? What are some things that you have to think about when you're doing that model, that release model?
So, you know, for Java Shop that we release AMIs, we basically have three layers of containers. So, each team is responsible for a war, essentially. But on top of that, so we have a standard war build practice, and you test that war. So the question was kind of around testing strategies and packages for packages. And then we also use a Gradle plugin, which Nebula OS package, which is open source, to take that war and actually create a Debian or RPM package, depending on what OS you're on.
Oh, nice.
And that is our second layer of distribution. So you could, in theory, push a war out, but we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You have a Debian package, and then that is baked into an AMI, which is then scaled up and tested and deployed. But our end unit of deployment is a AMI or OS, and that's what ends up getting scaled up in the cloud. In theory, you could take that Debian and install it on a Vagrant image locally. The trick there for us...
Do you test that?
Yeah, I would assume so. And part of the installation and booting up, you would have a smoke test involved with making sure your application comes up. The trick there is that when you're building this Debian and you're going to bake it into an OS, you're assuming at Netflix that it's installing on a base AMI, which is a pre-set up OS image that has all the bells and whistles that a Netflix service needs. We would have to have an equivalent Vagrant image for you to use locally. That's the complicated part with using... You could use something like Chef or Puppet to every single time you deploy, my Chef installation packages could depend on a common set, and then I can wait for however long that takes to set up the standard organization.
Right. So I'm assuming then, though, with those final AMI images, you have some of the things that you need to worry about with standard packaging stuff. So things like versioning, I'm assuming you have to deal with that. But you probably don't have to deal with what we're just talking about, like upgrades. I mean, because you're not going to ever upgrade that.
Yeah.
But you still have to do some things. So it's not... like versioning and stuff, I'm assuming.
So when you say versions like of Debian packages?
No. Yeah. Like the AMI that we're about to deploy out to all of our cloud is version 1.2.3.4, or there's some versioning scheme.
We have a unique naming scheme based on that build. So it's all traced back to a commit or a build in Jenkins, things like that.
Oh, nice. Awesome. Well, actually, on that note, I mean, we could talk about packaging styles and pros and cons. In fact, some of the other topics, we unfortunately didn't even have a chance to sort of dive into because we got kind of our technical deep dive on just the types of packaging. This is certainly a topic that we could talk on for quite a while. But we'd love to hear what struggles listeners deal with in their packaging woes and little horror stories that they've had to deal with installers and packaging. We'd love to hear that. And also, what's your biggest pet peeve having to deal with packages? What should we try to stop doing? Is it putting things in opt or something?
No, it's all of it.
It's all of it.
It's everything about packaging is terrible. it's just the least. Like honestly, I was mentioning earlier, I really feel a lot better building things from source nowadays because at least I can trust that thing I built. It's when you actually have to build an entire framework and CI and there's all these other places to go wrong to actually generate these things. That's when you just start getting yourself into trouble.
So you basically
asked for it by going down the path to packaging. You've already failed packaging. Like it's a test.
So if you're listening to Seth and his point of view, it's like Salesforce, no software, no packages.
No software, no packages. If you can avoid it, avoid it.
All right. Well, Seth, it's the last word with Seth Thomas. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ship Show. Welcome back to the Ship Show. So for our last segment tonight, we are doing the venerable tooltip. Our tooltip tonight is a tool called GitRob. We will link to it in the show notes. And it is a tool for parsing information about your GitHub repositories. Pete, had you seen this at all? It seems like something that, well, we've all run into this. It's trying to solve the problem where people upload credentials, you know, SSH keys or Amazon API keys, things like that to GitHub. And then they has a sad when that happens because it's not good. But had you seen this, Pete? It's, I would imagine it's kind of like it's part of that application security hardening stuff.
No, it's definitely awesome. I mean, SoundCloud's been coming out with a lot of interesting new open source software, but desperately something that's needed. I know, because I've heard of things just as simple as, you know, different people having bots running against the GitHub search API, and once they see API keys for Amazon, they start spinning up nodes
and mining
like Bitcoin, right?
Yep.
So this is
oh, those crazy kids.
Those silly kids, or like Russian mafia, I don't know.
Yeah. One of the two. It is one of two. And in fact, actually in this page there are some screenshots of like with the credentials blurred out, but it's like, look what I found just
you can find a surprising amount of stuff. I think I like the example that I like most is like somebody accidentally checked in their KeyPass database, which is already encrypted, but at the same time, you can sit there and crank on it if you wanted to, and then get access to whatever they had. It's kind of cool that the tool checks for all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's set up to like be continuously run, and so I like that. So it's basically kind of like monitoring for this stuff. But the other thing too is it follows everybody in your organization. So if you have a private GitHub repo where your code is, it makes sure that they don't accidentally leak stuff to like a public repo by changing, you know, remote accidentally or something like that, which I think is super
useful. This is why you have release engineers. This is, I mean...
So that would take us into a whole conversation about this entire problem was created by Git, and Linus's answer to it is, I don't give a shit because open source. And so we could totally have that argument, but we live in the world in which we live, and I can hear people going, oh, that Paul's going to talk about source control again. But we're unfortunately in a world where we're probably not going back to all using Subversion ever again. So the answer is, Yusuf, I'm totally on the same page with you about that, but it's like, what are you going to do? Like, if you have your source in Git.
I feel like this is a great component to a future show on like managing your secure cloud company assets in the cloud.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
Like doing GitHub, and then you mentioned Package Cloud. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole slew of sensitive areas we could definitely cover in a show like that.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good call, and we'll put that on the agenda, because it's one of those things where if you do it wrong and you have sad, like it's a bad day. It's a really bad day if you get that wrong. It actually reminds me of speaking of Subversion, the company that did the Subversion and Git hosting that had all their stuff on S3 and went bye-bye.
Code Spaces, I think they were.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, scary, scary.
Yeah. All right, well, conferences coming up. We've got a number of conferences coming up that we wanted to announce. Lean UX, April 15th through the 19th. That's in New York. I'll actually be speaking there. They have a whole DevOps space, so it's not just like lean, and it's not user experience exactly. It's an interesting mix of speakers on all sorts of topics. ChefConf 2015 in Santa Clara, that's March 31st through April 2nd. And then Velocity Santa Clara, obviously, is coming up May 20th. 27th through the 29th, and so you should check that out. Certainly, we'll put a link in the show notes for where you can grab your Velocity pass if that's your conference of the year that you like to go to.
There's also the Game Developers Conference that's going, I believe, March. It's the week of March 1st through 7th, depending on if you're going to the sessions or not. It may be longer or shorter, but I believe it's 4th through 6th is the expo dates.
Nice. Where?
Oh, sorry, San Francisco, where it always is.
Oh.
It's in the same...
My hometown.
Is it? I guess it's Moscone Center, you know, that... I mean, it's the place where you do the big enterprise-y conferences.
Yeah.
You know that place. You may live there.
I do indeed. They're tearing that whole area to shreds. And
yeah, it's kind of terrible. If I didn't have reasons to be there, I would probably not be going. I don't want to go to Soma again and stay in the same hotel that I stay at when I stay in Soma. Can I visit other parts of California, please?
Yeah, please. All right, so we would like to thank our sponsor for this episode, PagerDuty. Certainly check them out. If you are having woes with your monitoring and being paged, they have a solution for you. So from San Francisco, with all of the construction, this is Paul Reed signing off.
From sunny San Diego, this is Yusuf signing off.
From snowy Hoth, Boston, this is Pete signing off.
From surprisingly sunny Seattle, this is Seth signing off.
And from Los Gatos, California, this is Mike signing off.
I thought you were going to say Sunnyvale. That would have completed the sunniness.
Oh, damn it.
So you ruined our
so
sun.
Slow on my feet. Stupid feet.
And we will call in a couple weeks.